Good evening. I'm Paul Ramsey, and I'm speaking for the C.S. Lewis Committee. One has a great deal of committee work in university, and one from time to time complains about it. I will not complain about this committee because it's been a great pleasure. I've loved working with it. I've loved being part of it from its beginning. I've enjoyed the people we've brought in, and it's been a pleasure to work with the people on the committee, including Charles Hummel, who is our mentor. Our speaker tonight on the spirituality of C.S. Lewis is Dr. James M. Houston. Dr. James M. Houston, like many a speaker who's been here, many a good speaker who's been here has an impressive dossier. In fact, it's also the case that many a not-so-good speaker who's been here has an impressive dossier. I make that slight attempt at humor with some confidence, since I can speak not only as a theoretician and historian, but as a witness. I heard him speak informally last night, and I assure you, you will enjoy him. I don't believe in reciting dossiers, and if I did, I'd be taking up a lot of time. He was at university lecturer at Oxford. He was a geographer before he decided to devote his full life to the kind of ministry he does. He's currently visiting professor at Fuller Theological Seminary, and like many people who come here to speak, he's taught in colleges, but unlike most who've come here, he's also founded them. He's a founder and chancellor of Regent College in Vancouver. He has, as one would expect, a long list of publications, and one he's very pleased with and would like to have mentioned, and I'm sure it's one of several. He's currently the editor of Classics of Faith and Meditation by the Multnomah Press in Portland, Oregon, which do versions for modern current readers of the spiritual classics of Bernard of Clairvaux, St. Teresa of Avila, and others. And what he's doing, changing into language for the people of his place and time, is a long tradition of earlier Christian writings, is a long tradition. It was done by Nicholas Farrar and probably by his friend George Herbert in England. Anyway, this is a very valuable thing he does, as many others. I want to wander away from what appears to be my introduction and reminisce a little. When I lived in Elmira, New York, I had a neighbor right across the street, slightly kitty-corner, who was a lovely neighbor. She was dignified. She had great Christmas. She walked briskly. She was then distinctly older than I am now. She had reached an impressive age. And she was a neighbor of whom we were very fond. She was reticent. And I'm bringing her up partly because it's a great pleasure to remember good neighbors over many years, but also because of a very real analogy. Her name was Ida Langdon. And while I was at Elmira College, she gave, for the first time in her life, a public address. It was an excellent public address about her uncle, Mark Twain. Tonight, James Houston will give his first public lecture about his personal relationship to his counselor and friend, C.S. Lewis. James Houston.
Ladies and gentlemen, our chairman has warned us that distinguished speakers may not be always as exciting and humorous in spite of their qualifications. But I do want to add that I'm perhaps a liability to many of you this evening, because I've come here under the aegis of this coordinating committee of the C.S. Lewis lecturer. But I noticed in the paper, the Chattanooga Times of yesterday, that I'm billed as having a wife of 32 hours a son, 3 daughters, and 6 grandchildren. Now, after we'd been married a year, we had a little boy, and as he was growing up, he used to say, "You know, my mommy and daddy got married, and the very next day I was born." But that at least was 24 hours plus a year. But 32 hours is really moving things fast, isn't it? Well, now, this evening, our subject is the spirituality of C.S. Lewis, and as has been mentioned, this is the first time that I've publicly spoken on Lewis. I have done it informally in various C.S. Lewis societies, but as a lecture, this is the first time. And the reason for that is because I didn't want to capitalize on my association with Lewis as I knew him during the 1940s. And yet, as I reflect now, I realize what a tremendous debt I owe to this man, and indeed how profoundly he has shaped my life in the venture of moving out of Oxford and helping to establish a lay training center for Christian studies. And basically the reason was that instead of making all this fuss about one man, we need to educate 10,000 like him. And so the best tribute we could make to Lewis tonight is not to flatter his name, but to be inspired to follow in his steps. The term spirituality is one that is unknown in some of our Christian traditions, while in others it is esteemed and well used, for it refers to that inner dimension of a person called the spirit, the deeper center of an individual. It is a sphere where a person is open to the transcendental dimension of what the Puritan divine Henry Scougal called in his famous book, The Life of God in the Soul of Man. It's what the Apostle Paul before him said, that to be spiritually minded is life and peace. So we may say that spirituality is the study of the discipline of being spiritually minded upon the things of God. So it deals with prayer, with spiritual direction, with the exercise of a Christian mind, and with the various insights that guide the Christian pilgrim on his inward journey before God and towards God. As a serious study, this discipline of spirituality is still in the making, involving personal biography, philosophical and theological concepts, and is therefore essentially a cross-disciplinary field of study. C.S. Lewis himself never spoke of spirituality. It wasn't then a term much in vogue. And I feel sure that he would only have lent his name to such a subject after a careful definition of the word. He would have done so because he was a precise scholar, well aware of the magic with which words have their usage and how slippery they can become in abuse. So he wrote indeed a book, A Study of Words, in which he gave from a series of lectures on the need for definitions. And I'm sure that perhaps spirituality might have been one of the words that he would have chosen were he alive today. It is surely the work of the Holy Spirit in the hearts of men that is what we mean by spirituality, although the word is used very much more broadly of any spiritual faith, indeed of any religion. But Lewis himself, as he discerned what we mean by this, would have denounced the Gnostic and the Neoplatonic attitudes that we find in some attitudes of spirituality, or assuming that the superiority of the spiritual over the material reality, or indeed, sometimes, those forms of spirituality which are expressive of an anti-material understanding of faith. For, in a profound sense, Lewis was anti-spiritual. The robust earthly realism of his own faith was a counterpart to those tendencies. He was also a very modest and shy man who would never have dreamt of having a spirituality that could be talked about him, let alone emulated. I remember vividly when in 1951-52 he was first invited to come and do a lecture tour of the United States. I asked him why he had cancelled the trip. "God forbid," he said, when he began to realize the fuss that we were made over him. He says, "I don't want to be eaten alive," as he anticipated all the adulation that would be made of him. And so, as you know, he never came. As I've said, he was anti-spiritual in one sense. And he describes in one of Screwtape's letters how Wormwood is to keep the mind of his patient on this inner life. Quote, "He thinks his conversion is something inside him, and his attention is therefore chiefly turned at present to the stages of his own mind, or rather to that very expurgated version of them, which is all you should allow him to see. Encourage this. Keep his mind off the most elementary duties by directing it to the most advanced and spiritual ones. Aggravate that most useful characteristic, the horror and the neglect of the obvious. You must bring him to a condition in which he can practice self-examination for 1 hour without discovering any of those facts about himself which are perfectly clear to anyone who's ever lived in the same house with him or worked in the same office. Likewise with his prayers, the patient has to be so abstracted from thinking about his real mother that he ends up praying notionally about an imaginary person who is not his mother at all. For it is no doubt impossible to prevent his praying for his mother, but we have to render these prayers innocuous. So make sure that they're always very spiritual, that he is always concerned about the state of her soul and never about her rheumatism. Two advantages will follow. In the first place, his attention will be kept on what he regards as her sins, by which, with a little guidance, he can be induced to mean any of her actions which are inconvenient or irritating to him. And in the second place, since his ideas about her soul are so crude and erroneous, he will in some degree come to pray about an imaginary person. Lewis observed that when two people, of course, live together for some time, they develop antipathies about the other that irritate and annoy to the point of losing all personal contact with each other. And so it is here that the spiritual welfare that one professes to have for the other has become altogether spurious and unreal. Lewis writes this of Lewis, in writing this letter of Screwtape's, does it so vividly that one wonders if he is not, in fact, thinking about his own difficult relationship with Mrs. Moore, whom he took into his home for many years on the death of his friend just after the First World War. And so we see that Lewis developed an earthy realism about his faith so that he could never be accused of being so heavenly minded that he was no earthly use. So let me first of all elaborate on this unspiritual realism of the man's life. In the preface of his BBC talks, broadcast talks, he says of himself, "There's no mystery about my position. I'm a very ordinary layman of the Church of England, not especially high, not especially low, not especially anything else." Perhaps the best description is given, in fact, of him in the character of Badger in Kenneth Graham's delightful children's storybook, The Wind in the Willows. "That extraordinary amalgam of high rank, coarse manners, gruffness, shyness, and goodness. The child who has once met Mr. Badger has met ever afterwards in its bones a knowledge of humanity and of English social history which he could not get in any other way." How true this is of Lewis himself. When I first met him in the 1940s, he looked like Mr. Badger, stout, in an old rumpled tweed jacket and corduroy pants, brown shoes, pipe in mouth, looking like an Oxford farmer. Except that once he began to speak, no farmer I ever knew articulated so well, so humorously, so exactly to the point. In his first poem, a collection published posthumously, the credo of his poetic program spells out further this earthy, no-nonsense style of his faith and life. He says, "I am so coarse, the things the poets see are obstinately invisible to me. For 20 years I have stared my level best to see if evening, any evening, would suggest a patient etherized upon a table. In vain. I simply wasn't able. To me, each evening looked far more like the departure from a silent yet a crowded shore of a ship whose freight was everything, leaving behind gracefully, finally without farewells, marooned mankind. I'm like that odd man, Wordsworth knew. to whom a primrose was a yellow primrose, one whose doom keeps him forever in the list of dunces, compelled to live on stock responses, making the poor best that I can of dull things. Such is Lewis' description of himself. He's telling us, in other words, that he's no mystic, that his spirituality is prosaic, it's ordinary, homespun about the objective world. And so, for example, instead of saying that we must be spiritually regenerated, he rather says we're like eggs at present. And you can't go on indefinitely being just an ordinary, decent egg. We must be hatched or we go bad. Thus, his style is vivid, concrete, practical, what we would say in England, empty of gas, and full of solid stuff. If Robert Burns speaks of his love as a red, red rose, and William Wordsworth speaks of his like a shy violet only half disclosed, Lewis will tell us that there's no mystery about each of these reactions, for each is describing a very different kind of woman to the poet. And so this down-to-earthiness about Lewis is perhaps the greatest impression that I first had of him when we used to meet occasionally for evening salons in our own apartment to listen and to interact with some 15 or 20 guests. For I used to live in the home of Nicholas Zernoff, who was then the leader of the Orthodox community in England. We shared an apartment together. And while still a young bachelor, we spent 5 years in this happy circle. The friends that we used to have over on a Wednesday evening included Austin Farah, Hugo Dyson, E.L. Maskell, A.P. Dongtrev, Ian Crombie, Basil Mitchell, Michael Foster, Donald McKinnon, V.A. Demant, Lord David Cecil, and Jervis Matthew, many of whom were subsequently to be identified with the group that we call the Inklings. They were all equally bright and independent thinkers, and with an extraordinary diversity of views on church life. But where Lewis rose above them all was in the quick-witted way he used to draw absurd analogies that stopped an argument short in its tracks, and then revealing the gaping chasm of absurdity, the guffaw of the audience would drown the unfortunate opponent. More rationalistic people, like some of the logical positivists, who were then becoming the ruling princes of academia, thought this was a dirty trick that Lewis kept on playing, for it was like throwing dust in the eyes of a pursuer, half-choking, half-blinding and choking the unfortunate victim. But there was one person who was determined not to be so tricked, and this was Miss G.E.M. Anscombe, who in a celebrated meeting of the Socratic Club on February the 2nd, 1948, then tutor in philosophy at Somerville College, literally stopped Lewis in his tracks. Using his usual approach of the reductio ad absurdum argument as a means of attacking naturalism, she challenged his methodology much more effectively than anyone else had ever done before or since. 10 years later, when he rewrote his book on miracles, he extended the third chapter on the cardinal difficulty of naturalism, which had been the subject of the debate, three times its original length. Not because his previous argument had been wrong, but because he now saw, chastely, that ridicule is not the way with which to defeat your opponent. And so that evening he learnt an important lesson in this humiliating encounter with Miss Anscombe. This aside, the unpretentiousness of Lewis's own character, with his great intellectual skills as both originally a philosophy tutor and then a great literary critic, was a formidable arsenal for the defense of the Christian witness at Oxford. Those of us who lived much more in fear of being ridiculed for our faith in the secular atmosphere then prevailing among our colleagues were grateful for his massive attacks against the prevailing secular snobbery. We may describe this at several levels. First, Lewis was unashamedly articulate about his faith. In a society where to talk religion was a sconceable offense at college dining table, where no one talked about his faith than one did about one's kidneys, they were the concealed part of one's life, after all, Lewis was condemned for a tasteless lack of table manners. It was offensive to talk about such private things, and even worse, to make money in writing books about it. And so in the cultural skidding around of such a mindset, Lewis could only drive through regardless. So Lewis was deliberately noisy, laughing, realistic about this offense and scandal, which to many of his scholarly contemporaries was contemptible. Attack, rather than self-protection, was his only way through the impasse. It was also offensive to his colleagues that he should make his reputation with this popular image as a bestseller in a discipline where he was trespassing the bounds of academic propriety. How could he dare to write in theology when he was no trained theologian? And so, faced with this role as a layman in the pulpit of Great St. Mary's, the University Church, he on one occasion meekly explained that he was only doing his war work. After all, even absent-minded dons were manning the fire pump. One of my colleagues who was so hopeless in administration that he couldn't even find the telephone when it rang because it was buried under the books on his table, was doing his war work. And so Lewis, mindful of this kind of incongruity that was taking place, realized that there were those who were joining the amateurish ranks of the land army as volunteers, and so perhaps there was a place for a scholar of English speaking to the RAF pilots at their air bases about their life and their future. At least that is how Lewis presented himself as a lecturer when he was appointed by the Dean of St. Paul's to speak first to a group of pilots at Abingdon Airfield near to Oxford in 1941. He thought this first talk that he gave to the airmen was a complete flop, and yet it contained the seeds of the book that he later was to publish as broadcast talks, when after he had radioed to the whole nation, and this had launched Lewis as a Christian apologetic that in fact is perhaps the best in this century. It's one of the ironies of history that the people that we paid more attention to in theology, like C.S. Lewis and Jacques Ellul and perhaps Paul Tournier, have never been trained at all in theology. Why was this? Well, for one thing, Lewis was a man's man, who enjoyed life, cultivated friendships and conviviality. And perhaps it is revealing that G.K. Chesterton was one of Lewis's great heroes, full of mirth and common sense. Indeed, Lewis's style of faith has been described as a breezy, outdoor, Chestertonian Christianity. What helped Lewis's independence of mind were the friends he associated with. The friends that I knew in our Wednesday evening circle were all very different in their traditions of faith. Jervis Matthew and Professor Dongtrev and J.R. Tolkien were Roman Catholics. Nicholas Zernoff and some of his friends that came on occasion were Eastern Orthodox. Hugo Dyson was a high churchman. Basil Mitchell and Michael Foster were low Anglicans. And in a letter to Owen Barfield, he said, "Don't imagine I didn't pitch into Charles Williams for his obscurity for all I was worth." And this is what he did. He constantly was on the attack among his friends. He did the same with Owen Barfield over his views on theosophy. And vividly, I remember one Wednesday evening when he upset all the Catholics present when he gave a vehement attack against the cult of Mariolatry, of the cult of the Virgin. The fact is, Lewis loved a good scrap. And the Socratic Club on Friday nights was kept in lively debate by his chairmanship of such events. Lewis was indeed against the stream in the literary world that he also inhabited. He fought spirited battles with literary critics like Tillyard and Lewes, and in his inaugural lecture in Cambridge in 1954, he presented himself as a relic of old Western man, a breed becoming as extinct as a dinosaur. The fact is that he did suffer a great deal of odium theologium, to a painful degree. He was acutely aware in his theological books such as Mere Christianity and Screwtape Letters that he was being as much hated as he was also being loved. There were extremities in the viewpoints towards him. He was a controversial figure. And Oxford Dons especially objected to Lewis for advertising the fact that he was a Christian. His way of putting intellectual and moral pressure upon them for the purpose of converting was to them offensive of university etiquette. His evangelism was vulgar to their eyes, and his take-it-or-leave-it attitude made things worse. To do things politely, he should at least have been tentative about his views. He should have begun all his arguments with the phrase, "It could be argued that." Instead, here was a man who blandished his argument like a battle axe and who scorned as trivial anything short of falling down on his knees before the Almighty God. The intensity then of his thought, the sharpness of his polemic, and the lively wit with which he brought to bear an unabashedly open conflict with the university establishment was never forgotten. For Lewis was never awarded with a professorial chair at Oxford. He had to leave to receive one at Cambridge. It has been suggested that while the Irish, and he was Irish, are openly frank about their religion, the English are allergic. And so Irish Lewis fell foul of the pucker Englishness of Oxford. Yet it is this insistence of Lewis to be argued with or rejected that gives him great powers over his readers. His books are active. They act subliminally upon our conscience. He ambushes us when we least expect it, and either we enter fully into conflict with his attacks, or else we flee defeated. But the cosmic conflict that he introduces us into challenges us to believe that this is the most real and serious view of life that we may ever have the opportunity to decide upon. And so, like Chesterton, he lit up the cosmic conflict between the powers of darkness and the powers of light in all of human endeavor. For he inhabited a world illuminated by divine order, yet could see it taking place on a London double-decker bus. The chasm between heaven and hell was simply across the aisle between one reader and another. Nothing trivial lies outside the scope of the scrutiny that separates belief from unbelief or obedience from disobedience. For Lewis sensed vividly the struggle between angel and devil in every man's daily moral vacillations. And that's why he's so unpalatable to some and so challenging to others. He leaves no half-truths unsaid, no half-measures undone. And so paradoxically, and this is the first trait that I want to emphasize this evening, his unspiritual realism is in fact intensely spiritual. For Lewis seems to believe that the more spiritually mature a person becomes, the greater will the capacity be given for comprehending the grandeur and the goodness of God. So as the children in the Narnia stories experience more about Aslan the lion that represents the nature of God, the more terrifying he becomes. At the beginning, at the name of Aslan, each one of the children felt something jump in his inside. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Lucy could never decide that romping with Aslan was like playing with a thunderstorm or playing with a kitten. Such occasional familiarity with his followers never diminished his awesome majesty. It reminds us of the dialogue about God in The Wind of the Willows, a book that Lewis much appreciated. "Afraid," murmured the rat, his eyes shining with unutterable love. Afraid of him? Oh, never, never. And yet, oh Mole, I am afraid. In the trilogy of the science fiction books, Lewis portrays with much imaginative skill the intense interpenetration of spiritual realities by the spiritual struggle of good and evil, and yet of the unswerving sovereignty of God, ultimately, over all his creation. God's authority is also God's initiative in Lewis's writings. In The Silver Chair, Jill first meets God as Aslan, as a stream standing between her and the water. In a heavy golden voice, he bade her come and assuage her thirst. She finally admitted she was nearly frantic with thirst. So again he bade her drink. Awkwardly, she asked him to go away while she drank. But his only answer was a look and a low growl. "Will you promise to do anything to me if I do come?" said Jill. "I make no promise," said the lion. "Do you eat girls?" she asked. "I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms," said the lion. He didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor even if it were angry. He just said it. "I didn't come and drink," said Jill. "Then you will die of thirst," said the lion. "Oh dear," said Jill, coming another step nearer. "I suppose I must go and look for another stream then." "There is no other stream," said the lion. This is the uniqueness and intransigence of God's revelation in the gospel, the offense to so many that Lewis unflinchingly proclaimed. Of course, as soon as Jill drank from the stream, her thirst was quenched, her mind was cleared to see that she needed forgiveness. Then Aslan told her the purpose for which he had called her out of her own world. Jill objected that she had not been called. She had called out and asked for a way of escape, then found an open door which led her into this other land. And so the lion replied, "You would not have called to me unless I had been calling to you." And so Lewis indicates that it is also the initiative of God that really explains any move that we might make towards him. In each of the children's stories, there's the same ecstatic, indescribable joy and beauty at the climax of meeting Aslan. In The Horse and His Boy, Shasta, when he meets the lion, falls at its feet, smelling the strange and solemn perfume of its mane. When he disappears in a swirl of brightness, the deep paw print in the earth brims over with a pool of water where Shasta also refreshes himself, like Jill had done. So delicious and delighting to all the children who drank. Yet Aslan deals with each child uniquely, to bring him or her to the same place of conversion and repentance of heart. When asked what his relationship may be with other people, he always answers, "I'm telling you your story, not another. I tell no one any story but his own." It's always then a uniquely personal encounter with God. In the case of Diggory and the magician's nephew, he looks up in despair into Aslan's face, only to find the tawny face was bent down over his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, light tears compared with Diggory's own, that for a moment he felt as if the lion must really be sorrowier about his mother than he was himself. And so this gave Diggory strength and courage at once. So there we have some vignettes of the realism of Lewis's faith. The second thing I want to briefly sketch this evening in the spirituality of Lewis is, of course, his prayer life. In his children's stories, he reveals perhaps more of his own more intimate faith in the gospel than even in his Christian apologetics. But prayer, perhaps more than anything else, is the true test of a Christian's devotion, of his intimacy with God. And especially in Letters to Malcolm, where Lewis deals with prayer at the end of his life, he admits prayer is a subject that is always a good deal in my mind. And then he adds, I mean private prayer. For liturgy and corporate worship was not something that ever enthused Lewis. He objected to frequenting, for example, the church to pray because 9 months out of the 12, it would be too freezing cold to be able to do so comfortably. And then when he did pray in church, there was always the good-meaning char that was disturbing the peace and sweeping the floor in front of him. And so Lewis really took rather a cool view of going to church to pray. Rather, for Lewis, prayer was like a good shoe, something that should be personal, comfortable, and permanent without any need of novelty and change. As Mark Twain once said, the occasion when you can't tell a lie is when you pray. And so says Lewis, the prayer preceding all prayers is, may it be the real I who speaks. May it be the real thou that I speak to. Only God can in his mercy shatter every idea that we may form of him. The most blessed result of prayer would be to rise thinking, but I never dreamed. I suppose it was at such a moment that Thomas Aquinas himself said of his own theology, it reminds me of straw. And so to enter into the presence of God was for Lewis to realize the distinction between the creature and the creator, between the superficially real and the ultimately real. Prayer, then, is learning to reach out from the incomplete embryonic person that I am to the utterly concrete person that Jesus Christ is. Because of this, Lewis was impatient with lectionaries and with ready-made prayers. Apart from the use of the Lord's Prayer, he saw that one's intercourse with God, like Aslan's dealing with each child, should be unique. Since I have my own faith, prayer, says Lewis, keeps me in touch with sound doctrine in the way I need it. And secondly, it reminds me of what I ought to ask, especially in my intercessory prayers for others. And thirdly, as prayer is a relationship far more intimate than any relationship between two creatures, it is less to be considered like an erotic relation, for I fell at his feet as one dead, says the seer. So such intimacy in prayer made Lewis feel that the exercise of prayer should be largely non-verbal. Even in praying for others, he says, I believe I tended to avoid their names and to substitute mental images off them. I still think the prayer without words is the best prayer, if one can really achieve it. I don't think I mean anything so exalted as what the mystics call the prayer of silence. Practically, he adds that bodily senses are such that no one in his senses, if he has any power of ordering his own day, would reserve his chief prayers for bedtime. Obviously, the worst possible hour for any action which needs concentration. Lewis was the kind of chap that once he had put his head to his pillow, he went straight off to sleep. And so prayers at night were not for Lewis. My own plan, when hard-pressed, is to seize any time and place, however unsuitable, in preference to the last waking moment. On a day of travelling, I'd rather pray sitting in a crowded train than put it off till midnight, when one reaches a hotel bedroom with aching back and dry throat and one's mind already partly in a stupor and partly in a whirl. And so in a letter to a friend in 1955, just after he had gone up to Cambridge to teach there, he used to return every weekend back to his home, which he kept in Oxford. And the journey between Cambridge and Oxford is across what one of my colleagues called the academic lowland. And it's a cross-country journey where the slow train, crawls through the green fields and stopping at nearly every telegraph pole. And so Lewis used to say that this was an excellent occasion to take a slow train, precisely because the service was so slow, and in most people's eyes so bad, the trains were almost empty. And so I got through a lot of reading and also a lot of prayer. A solitary railway journey, I found, was quite excellent for this purpose. Since Lewis is primarily an apologist, his focus in what he writes about prayer concerns the theology of prayer and how its intent and practice of petitions can be defended. But the problems he's concerned about are not those of the skeptic and the non-believer, but the relationships between the believer and God. And so he typically asks such questions as, does prayer make any difference? Does prayer change the course of events? Does it change God or his actions in any way? One of his essays on the efficacy of prayer, Lewis narrates how he was booked to go to London and the event was cancelled. And so he said, I decided to put off going to the hairdresser also. He was going to go make his appearance a bit smarter and going out for his appointment. But a nagging inner voice said, get it cut just the same. Go and get it cut. And like Martin Luther's hairdresser, Luther's was also a Christian. The moment I entered his shop door, he said, oh, I was praying that you might come in today. And in fact, if I had come a day or two later, I would have been no use to him. It awes me still. How then, asks Lewis, can we measure the efficacy of prayer? We can never attain empirical proofs of it, as in science, for the essence of prayerful request is that it may or it may not be granted. An infinitely wise God may from time to time listen to the requests of foolish and finite beings, and sometimes he will grant them and sometimes not. So prayer cannot have a direct causal efficacy, he argues. Therefore, to ask, does prayer work, is to Lewis a misleading question. It misunderstands the very nature of prayer. Well then, we may scrap, argues Lewis, the whole idea of petitionary prayer. This would make Christianity, intellectually perhaps, a far easier religion if it told us to do this. But Lewis disagrees that we can do so. What about petitions for forgiveness of sins? What about petitions in the unpredictable vicissitudes of life? Don't we pray sometimes when we're gripped by anxieties and other distresses? Could it not be then, argued Lewis, that God is in our action to be moved to pray, as well as in our desire that he do something about it? Might it not also be God who prompts us to pray, as well as we who pray, God may be prompted to act? And so we conclude that prayer is not causal and mechanical, it is relational. It's the Holy Spirit that whispers to us the possibility of prayer. It's Jesus who stands beside us and articulates our prayer. And it's the Father who hears our prayer. And so he reminds us in one memorable passage of how the whole Trinity is involved in the very action that the simple believer who shuts his bedroom door and kneels down to pray is in fact moving the whole marvelous dynamic of the triune God, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. So religious people, argued Lewis, don't talk about the results of prayer. They talk of being answered or heard. It's the language of the suitor, of the child, of speaking to the Father who knows and loves and cares and heeds our cries. So prayer then is not magic. It's not direct action on nature. It's rather dialogue with God, just as Jesus had in the Garden of Gethsemane when he said, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. But then this leads Lewis into further tension over petitionary prayer. Indeed, he argues that adoration and worship are much simpler things to talk about than petition, which is so hard to fully understand. There are, in fact, says Lewis, two types of petitionary prayer. Type A is clear enough. It asks with reservation according to God's will in his name to be submissive to what God may do about it. It is the Gethsemane prayer. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. It is prayer that is based upon the goodness of God according to his wisdom and holiness. Such prayer, says Lewis, has no real problem. But over against it is pattern B. Again and again in the New Testament is the demand to have faith in God, the faith to remove mountains, to walk on the water like Peter did, to feed the 5,000, to have the faith to be healed. Do you believe that I can do this? The blind men are asked in Matthew 9:20. Indeed, five times over in Matthew's gospel, the disciples are rebuked because they are of little faith. We think of the challenge of John 14:13, that whatever you... It is possible that someone who has seen great answers to prayer is wholly on the B side, and is tempted to believe those wholly on the A side are grievously lacking in faith, and are wrong, therefore, in their petitions. Perhaps, then, the type A person pattern of humility and submissiveness can be just a cover for a lack of faith. Maybe it is, but then why is type A in the New Testament at all? Why does Jesus himself exemplify this kind of prayer life? And so Lewis, honestly, and this is where, of course, he charms us, he says, I have no answer to my problem, though I have taken it to about every Christian I know, learned or simple, lay or clerical, within my own communion and without. In other words, Lewis is not afraid to ask questions when they seem to be unanswerable to him and to others. The one hesitant thing one can say, adds Lewis, is that until God gives me the faith to move mountains, who created mountains, then without this gift I am best employed in exercising type A petitions. If, on the other hand, God ever gave me such a gift of faith, then I should again have no problem, for I would be exercising type B petitions. What we should be ashamed of is rather our moral complacency that we do not see enough miracles, nor ask in faith for them to happen more frequently. So on the night of his betrayal, how condescending of God in Christ that he should choose to identify with the weakest of his camp followers and to shrink sensitively from what he was about to suffer, asking for the cup to be taken from him. Moreover, Lewis noted, rather astutely, that miracles sometimes occur at the beginning of a Christian's life. It's as if, as the life of the Christian proceeds, miracles tend to become rarer, less needed perhaps to encourage mature Christians to grow in grace and in divine assurance. And so he says, the refusals too are not only more frequent, they become more unmistakable and more emphatic. And so Lewis would warn us that we should not come to too hasty a conclusion about our answers to prayer. If our prayers are sometimes answered, beyond all hope and probability, could it be that if we were stronger, we might be less tenderly treated by God? If we were braver, we might be sent, with far less help, to defend far more desperate posts in the great battles of life. Lewis was modest in his claims about his own exercise of prayer. In letters to Malcolm, he says, "You and I are people of the foothills. In the happy days when I was still a walker, I loved the hills and even mountain walks, but I was no climber. I hadn't the head. So now I do not attempt the precipices of mysticism." At the same time, Lewis recognized there was a level of prayer life lower than even ours. I don't mean that the people who occupy it are spiritually lower than we. They may far excel us, but their praying is of an astonishingly undeveloped type. And of course, by this type, he was referring to those who simply recite the Lord's Prayer by rote and don't seem to have very much else of a prayer life. As I mentioned before, Lewis believed that prayer without words was preferable to vocal prayer, unless one was too tired to concentrate without words. One of the things that Lewis also did was, from about 1940 onwards, he went to a priest for weekly confession. And he was able, in this very intimate way, to articulate his own needs before God. He also saw the need to exercise a spiritual sensibility and an implicit relationship with God, as well as believing an explicit doctrinal statement that he could do at a drop of a hat. But as Lewis has already admitted, he was no mystic. And so to climb the mystic heights was something he argued only a few might be called upon to explore. And so he warns us about Julian of Norwich as being a rather dangerous writer in his way of thinking. Indeed, he saw the possibility that some mystical writings or experiences might even be diabolical, while prayer induced by introspection might be no better than drug-induced experiences. At the same time, he wrestled much with the practical problems implicit, as we've seen, in causality and free will and petition. Like everyone else, Lewis went through dry and discouraging periods of prayer. Sometimes they may result, he argues, from our insistence about talking to God instead of allowing God to speak to us. So perhaps our aridity is because we excel as ventriloquists. Indeed, Augustine said, God gives where he finds empty hands. And so what we should note is that it is often little things that distract our attention in prayer, such as what we are going to do in the next hour, rather than being concerned about big issues. And so it's sensible, he says, not to try to keep up our normal schedule of prayer when we are very fatigued or sick. And also he reminds us that perhaps the beginner needs to be more rigorous in the regular habits of devotion, but that as one matures, one can be more sensible and be more flexible when those good habits have already been shaped. Lewis also warns us against cultivating warm feelings about prayer. If possible, advises Screwtape, keep the patient being tempted from praying at all. That's obvious. But if that fails, then encourage the prayer to look for good feelings as a substitute for true relationships with God. For whenever they are attending to the enemy himself, we're defeated. So deflect then their attention to their own feelings rather than to God himself. So when they ask for charity, let them be deflected by having very charitable feelings. When they pray for courage, let them feel brave. When they seek forgiveness, divert themselves to the experience of forgiving feelings. Teach them to eliminate the value of each prayer by the success in producing the right feelings. Avoid at all cost the real nakedness of the soul before God in prayer. It is that, argues Screwtape, that is so deadly, being in the living presence of God himself. So I think these quotations give you some idea also of the realism that Lewis has about his prayer life. Now we turn, thirdly, to Lewis as a spiritual director, as a counselor in spirituality. Lewis was far too modest to think of himself as a spiritual director. Moreover, it was not such a conscious need, other than in Catholic circles in his time. Certainly, evangelicals never saw its need. But when a don has been tutor for over 30 years, weekly advising his students in private tutorials for an hour apiece, then, of course, very often such students become friends for life. We think of Harry Blamires as one of those students that became a lifelong friend of C.S. Lewis. And it was out of this tutorial arrangement that the way was opened up for Lewis, and indeed for others of us who have seen the importance of this, to maintain this kind of relationship with our own students, with our own alumni, in a way that you don't have when you have a weekly lecture program and large classes. And, of course, because of the popularity that he achieved in the publication of his books, becoming famous through them, he began to have an extraordinary fan mail. It's estimated that Lewis wrote at least 20,000 letters. And it's no wonder that he developed an antipathy to correspondence. He tells us that the one essential of a happy life is that a man would have no mail and never dread the postman's knock. Yet to a number of people, he wrote over 100 letters apiece, such as we have in the published collection of Letters to an American Lady, whom he never thought he would meet, and never dreamed that one day such a collection of hastily replied cryptic notes would ever see the light of print. They were written in the snatches of a busy day, faithfully and loyally responded to, simply to encourage drooping spirits and doubting hearts. So there's no self-reminiscence, no urbanity, no other intent in his writing than to be faithful in God's service, expendable and lowly in his ministry. And this must have cost Lewis enormous energy. I remember even the late 1940s being awed by rumors that we then began to hear circulating of how many hours a day he was devoting to correspondence, and which his brother Major Lewis helped to get him through as his unofficial secretary. For in those days, a don did not have such luxuries as a personal secretary, even for academic correspondence. So he had to do everything himself. It's significant that two of Lewis's books develop this yawn of letters, Screwtape Letters that we've referred to, and Letters to Malcolm. And he saw that spiritual discernment was an essential need in giving advice. His own intimate friends were in fact surprised at the shrewdness of the psychological insights that he expressed in Screwtape Letters, which he published in 1941. For in those 31 letters written by the archdevil Screwtape to his apprentice, Wormwood, Screwtape directs Wormwood's attack on the progress of his patient in three distinct phases. In the first 12 letters, he talks about the ways in which one should prevent the Christian faith from taking root in a Christian's life. Letters 13 to 22 are about removing that faith once it has taken root. And letters 23 to 31 are about corrupting the well-rooted faith experience. Likewise, in Letters to Malcolm, Lewis again uses this epistolary genre in communicating with an old friend his thoughts about prayer. This probably is, in fact, just simply a literary device rather than an actual correspondence. But it's significant that Lewis saw the appropriateness of this genre in terms of personal communication, just like Ilred of Rivaux in the 12th century saw that if you communicate about friendship, he's written a book on spiritual friendship, then the appropriate way in talking about friendship is having a dialogue with three friends. And so in three acts, Ilred does this. Well, Lewis does the same thing with his genre of letter correspondence. It's a very effective way of giving spiritual direction. It shows faithfulness, intent, concern, compassion, and seeks to give encouragement to those who write. And it's one of the features of Lewis's life that he never disregarded the humblest of correspondents, whether it was a child, whether it was an illiterate woman, whoever it was, he had this humble, informal, homespun response. And for an old bachelor who did not marry until he was well into his late 50s, and who lived very much in a man's world as an Oxford don, he was surprisingly gentle and wise in his correspondence with women. Like Cardinal Fenelon and Francis de Sales in the 17th century, Lewis had a wide correspondence with ladies. Indeed, he tells us on one occasion, in writing to this American lady, that he's touched to think that after the announcement of his engagement, she's still writing to him. Most of them had dropped off. And so faithful and loyal was he as a correspondent that even when usually he had never initiated the correspondence, he allowed it to continue. And certainly one of the rebukes that Lewis has given to me is that it didn't matter how busy the timetable was in the middle of examination marking, he would still have time to write a brief note of acknowledgement, even if he didn't have the time to answer fully all the questions that were then being asked. One of the things, too, that we find about Lewis was that as a spiritual director, he was a man given to hospitality. In fact, I think he was really abused by many people in this respect. One of the reasons why I'd sort of dropped all public standing as far as knowing Lewis personally was the number of people I was pestered by who wanted me to arrange a luncheon. And their only purpose in being in Oxford was just to see Lewis. And yet, whenever this happened, he took it with such courtesy. I don't think perhaps in America we quite appreciate the cultural barrier that there is in England about not speaking to the stranger. For some 15 years, I used to pass the same colleague from another college at the corner of a road as we commuted to our respective colleges. Sometimes we glanced nervously at each other, sometimes we just looked the other way, but we never spoke, never said good morning. And it was only in 1971 when in the street in Vancouver I saw this man on the other side of the street and I ran across and said, "Don't you think we should have dinner tonight?" Well, that inhibition of never introducing yourself unless you've been formally introduced by a third party who knows you both well was an inhibition that, of course, was part of the Oxford life. And yet these young Americans who were constantly coming to Lewis and asking for an appointment, he accepted with great grace. In fact, I think it was a form of freedom for him in his inner being. And I think that very often we used to rather envy our American cousins who had this opportunity and this freedom to do that kind of thing. But professionally and locally, we couldn't do it ourselves. One of the things that Lewis was leery about in spiritual direction was a psychologist. We tend, of course, today to purchase professional friendships in the waiting room of the psychologist. But in 1947, on one occasion, Lewis wrote to a lady, says, "Keep clear of those psychiatrists unless you know that they're also Christians. Otherwise, they start with the assumption that your religion is an illusion and will try to cure it." This assumption, Lewis objected, was made as amateur philosophers and not as professional psychologists. So often, he adds, they have never given the question any serious thought. But he was pretty leery about these professional friends. He much suggested that it's better to not purchase such friendships, but simply be able to approach a good friend in Christ. He was also wise about the recommendation of books to read in spirituality. He loved Francis de Sales' Introduction to the Devout Life, and he said, "I would rather regard his prose," that's Francis's prose, "and George Herbert's verse as the sweetest of all religious writings." He also deeply appreciated George MacDonald's Unspoken Sermons as going to the very heart of the matter. Augustine's Confessions, Walter of Hilton's Stairway of Perfection, William Langland's Piers Plowman, Thomas A. Kempis's Imitation of Christ, Thomas Traherne's Centuries of Meditation. These were his favorites on his list of meditative books. And in reading such meditative books, he suggests, read a little bit at a time, more like sucking a lozenge than wolfing down a slice of bread. And suggested that sometimes to our devotional reading we could do with a mouthwash for the imagination of some good novel. Of course, he took for granted that the Bible came first in one's reading habits and recommended that one should use a good modern translation. He himself admired and used J.B. Phillips' version. But I remember a memorable occasion at the Ashmolean Lecture Hall when C.H. Dodd was giving a lecture on modern Bible translations and totally ignored any reference to J.B. Phillips' version. And the questioner asked him, and Lewis was there in the congregation, a questioner asked him what he thought of J.B. Phillips' translation. "J.B. Phillips? J.B. Phillips? I don't think I've ever heard of that translation," he retorted. This, of course, was a muted protest that Phillips' version was not a translation at all, but a mere paraphrase. And Lewis, I remember, laughed loudly at the response, for in fact, he had written in the preface his support of this translation. Perhaps Dodd's protest was actually cast against Lewis himself in writing this preface and in this support. Lewis was also called upon to be spiritual advisor at many levels. I was in contact with him when he was corresponding with Sheldon Van Auken. When Sheldon came up to Jesus College, I met weekly in a prayer group with his wife, Davy, as Sheldon called her. He was not then a Christian, but Davy asked us to pray for her husband's conversion. And on the day that he told her he had become a Christian, she announced this to us at the daily prayer group of the IQ with much joy. That evening, I met Lewis in our apartment and told him of the event of that morning. Without betraying any confidence that he had in his letters with Sheldon, Lewis replied, "Oh, I'm so glad," and then abruptly changed the subject, for he was not about to reveal any communication that had passed between them, even though he was an undergraduate, and certainly Lewis was not about to reveal his own soul. A day or two later, Sheldon then told Lewis personally what had happened, as I learnt later from Sheldon. As you know, later when David died, and knowing the excessive romanticism that Sheldon had shown in his courtship and marriage towards her, Lewis called her death a severe mercy. Indeed, as Lewis pointed out to him in a letter, Sheldon had been jealous of God for having David's heart so profoundly his. She was so much more mature as a Christian than Sheldon that he resented her prior commitment and loyalty to God. This was something that Sheldon could never hope to have, and so it became somewhat of a barrier between them. Jealous of God? Yes, Lewis had pointed out something profoundly true, and the consequences Sheldon began to see could be terrible. For what could have resulted if Sheldon had survived? She could have been more than ever in love with God, in gratitude for her recovery. And he could have been the more jealous of God as a result. Indeed, after her death, he went through a decade of feeling all loss of faith and distance from God in bitterness and distrust. Or another alternative might have been that Sheldon had used his marital persuasiveness to keep them united and so take Davy away from God. He sensed that there was a possible weakness in this direction. And a third alternative, had she lived, was that his jealousy of God might have turned into a flagrant hatred of God. And how terrible that might have been. And as Sheldon faced all three possibilities in her death, he came to confess, "Her death, it brought me as nothing could to know and end my jealousy of God. It saved her faith from assault. If her death did, in truth, have these results, it was precisely what Lewis had told me. It was a severe mercy." One of the things that comes out of this incident, I think, is the need for courage, moral courage, on the part of a spiritual friend to be able to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth in love. And so Sheldon said, "How discerning then of Lewis to speak so courageously and lovingly of the need of her death." Lewis had said, "Perpetual spring is never allowed to us. Winter has also to come." And as Lewis said further, "She was further on than you, and she can help you more where she now is than she could have done on earth." And so he says, after this secure and splendid letter, Sheldon comments, "I loved Lewis like a brother and a father combined." Well, we can be sure of this, that if this is simply the correspondence of one undergraduate who was totally unknown to Lewis when he wrote from America, one can't imagine the concealed realm of advice and spiritual counsel that over the years Lewis gave to us. We may admire his writing. His writing was only the tip of the iceberg. We should much more profoundly admire the character of the man, that he had such depth in the quality of his relationships. It's the richness of Lewis's relational life that is profoundly more significant than anything he ever communicated in print. Lewis, as we've said, was always giving out. But one of the things that we all need is to receive as well. We can only authentically give when we authentically receive. And so we have to ask, did Lewis have any to counsel him? Yes, he did. And especially he had a soul friend in Sister Penelope Lawson, who was an Anglican nun from a community nearby in Wantage. And in 1939, he began a lifelong correspondence with her. Whenever he had difficulty in dealing with Mrs. Moore, whose domestic problems increased as she got older, then Lewis would constantly write to Penelope and say, "Please pray for me." And she did. And he also had to ask for prayer for his brother, who was addicted to the bottle. Lewis, in fact, did not have an easy home life, a very difficult one. And so he was able, thankfully, to have somebody who was an intellectual match for him, and yet who was a spiritual advisor and gave him good counsel. You may remember that in his science novel, Perelandra, he dedicates it to the community of the ladies of Wantage. And Wantage, of course, was spelt with a capital W because it's the name of this small town near Oxford. But in the Portuguese translation, the translator couldn't make head or tail of Wantage, so he dedicated it to the wanton ladies. Which, for an Anglican community of nuns, is a pretty good distortion of the truth, rather like these 32 hours that I've been married. Just as tropical fruits require a tropical climate, so the spiritual life in the fellowship of God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit requires of us to develop deeply spiritual friendships at all levels. And so we find that Lewis was essentially a relational man, always surrounding himself with convivial friends. Originally, perhaps this was like Winston Churchill, who also surrounded himself with convivial friends to keep at bay what Churchill called the black dog. That's to say, his own mental depression. Lewis himself suffered from mental depressions as a youth, and both culturally and temperamentally, we find that in addition to perhaps his own initial personal need, Lewis was also, of course, a man who, living in Oxford, lived very much in a man's world. When you went for your swim, you went to Parsons Pleasure, which was an open-air swimming pool for men, discreetly shrouded by a high hedgerow, and where you swam in the Buff. And of course, when you meet people in that kind of situation, then you can be pretty sure that your relations with them are down to earth. Marriage, even for me in 1952, was a no-no for a serious academic. When I announced my engagement at Brasenose College that spring, some of my colleagues told me that my academic career was now really over. I could no longer achieve what I needed to do as a celibate don. And, of course, Lewis lived in that atmosphere. And it certainly, being a man's world, was very tough on the women folk. Wives tended to be kept very much in the background, and so they ate their boiled egg on toast for supper, while their husbands, dressed in evening suits, elegantly dined and wined at high table with the best chefs in England. That's why perhaps the wit flowed so spontaneously, because college sellers kept such good vintage stocks. And dons were pampered and spoilt by gourmet dinners that rivaled each other from college to college. And of course, in this context then, we see something of the conviviality of Lewis that was also part of the conviviality of the whole Oxford common room. But Lewis, par excellence, certainly had friends and kept them loyally and deeply. We mentioned some of the circle that we met on a Wednesday evening, but of course more intimately in the Inklings on a Tuesday at lunchtime, Charles Williams, and Tolly, as Tolkien was called, and Hugo Dyson, and Cecil Lewis and others, David Cecil and others, regularly met together with him. But the closest of all of Lewis's friends was his own brother. And so in a sense it was a series of concentric circles that moved ever outwards from a close domestic connection with his own brother within his own family, and then outward to these other friends, and then beyond that to others and others again. So there was a consistency in the expansiveness of the kind of friendships that he develops. At the same time, it's very interesting to read Lewis's study of philia, of friendship in the four loves, and to see how cautious he is about the exercise of friendship. Few value it, because, he says, few really experience it. And without being derogatory about it, he said that friendship is the least natural of loves, for it needs so much more deliberately to be chosen and sustained than eros. Nothing is less like a love affair, he says, than friendship. And so, therefore, he considers the caution and the shrewdness and the wisdom that we need in the connection of friendships. One of the things that perhaps Lewis wasn't sufficiently aware of is that spiritual friendship can only be profoundly fed and sustained by divine fellowship. And that, in turn, the communion of saints, those modelers, those exemplars of friendship in the past, require, therefore, attention as well. I'm sorry that the time is going on so fast and I haven't gone through all my material, but let me just try and summarize some of the concluding remarks. The last thing that I want to share with you is Lewis's journey towards eternal life. As a spiritual man, Lewis recognized that the Christian is a pilgrim in this world, that here we have no continuing city, but seek one to come. And this motif of the journey, which he had started in his Pilgrim's Regress in his first book, was one that was constantly with him, as we also find in The Great Divorce. And we find that in the course of this journey, there are a number of lessons that Lewis would leave with us, and it's with this we want to close. The first lesson, I think, that Lewis would give to us is that the Christian life is expressive of the fullness of life. And that he was aware that if our religion is fragmented, segmented from the rest of our life, it's a betrayal of our faith. Christ came to give us life and to give us life more abundantly. And so as we read Lewis, we discover that what he is talking about is the profound importance of the ebullience and the richness and the magnitude that life should be for us. Conventional religion that is not life-giving, he says, can only be death-giving. Its conventions are hollow, they're spurious. And he saw that eternal principles, which are not embodied in concrete human situations, can destroy us. And so he reminds us that for the fullness of that life, we do need friends. We do need guides to walk with us on our journey through life. The second lesson that Lewis would teach us is that we all need to see our daily human existence from another viewpoint than that of habit and of task. This complacency can be very blinding. And so Lewis himself was introduced into the Christian life through a mythopoeic approach. That is to say, in the realm of fairy tale, in the realm of imagination and of fantasy. It may be that we ourselves don't necessarily enter through that gateway.